It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Gas prices have been surging around the country following U.S. and Israeli attacks on Iran. In Wisconsin, the average price for a regular gallon of gas hit $3.15 on Monday, up nearly 40 cents from last week, according to data from AAA. That's also 20 cents higher than gas prices were at this time last year. Diesel also saw a price hike this week, with the average price per gallon topping $5 in some areas of the country. Crude oil prices pulled back significantly yesterday, which could slow that increase in gas and diesel. In just a bit, we'll talk to the owner of a trucking company out of Waukesha County about what she's seeing with diesel prices. First, Matt McLean is with us, petroleum analyst at Gas Buddy, a gas price tracking and savings app. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Anytime.
We've been seeing these gas prices go up around the country. Matt, what are we seeing here in Wisconsin?
You know, it's no different. We're looking at a global situation, and so the reality with that means that pretty much across the board, no matter where a state was at in their price points, we are seeing prices continuing to rise. In Wisconsin right now, the national average is $3.55 a gallon. It's up about 37 cents per gallon over just the last 7 days. It's not quite indicative because that's Tuesday to Tuesday, and on Monday we had already seen 10 to 15 cents in rise. So we're looking at about 50 cents a gallon on average nationwide. In Wisconsin, $3.18, prices are up about 25 to 35 cents over the past week and about 58 cents over the past month. And unfortunately, we've got more price hikes to go on in the coming days.
Why are you expecting more price hikes in the coming days? We saw some crude oil drops, but of course, that's going to be up and down.
Exactly. And the more conflicting statements that we get out of the administration right now, the more topsy-turvy the prices are going to get. You're going to see that volatility continue to increase as long as there is not a clear and concise plan of action stated by administration officials. President Trump himself even also conflicting statements yesterday, and the only reason why I bring that up, because we do not usually in any way, shape, or form become a partisan situation, is simply because the first set of comments that he made yesterday sent oil prices skyrocketing. At some point in the overnight electronic trading, we approached $120 a barrel. Yesterday afternoon, hours later, he made comments almost alluding to the idea that this conflict may be wrapping up, and that sent oil prices tumbling. In fact, on the day, it traded roughly about $95 a barrel whenever the market closed. Currently, we're sitting at $87.56 live right now. That's down about $7.21 on the West Texas Intermediate. That's handled out of the New York Exchange. Brent crude, handled out of the European Exchange, is sitting at $91.16, down about $7.80. But again, that is still being factored in from yesterday afternoon's comments. Now, this morning, we're seeing the Secretary of Defense talking about today may be the biggest day yet in the conflict, and other entities, the embassies for the United States, still evacuating non-essential staff members and other aspects. So the conflicting information is where we are seeing a large amount of volatility, and we need that message to get clear and concise.
I want to put today's prices, Matt, in long-term perspective. I was looking at your charts on Gas Buddy. Looks like our prices about the highest they've been in 2 years, but not at that level of post-COVID, where they're really spiking with that that sort of supply snapback around the world.
That's exactly right. And to give a comparison, that's basically the last time we saw prices even over $4 a gallon, some areas hitting $5 a gallon, unfortunately. And this time around, that proves to be true to our friends in California as well. So but beyond that, it's an apples to oranges comparison. You hit it right on the head there when it comes to the aspect of prices coming out of COVID. Everybody had spring fever. Everybody wanted to travel and do vacations all at the same time. But the oil refineries had been in a ramped down position because for a couple of years, nobody needed gas. Nobody was traveling. We were all sheltering in place, isolating, if you will. And so we had to ramp up production. But then we also had the Russia-Ukraine conflict thrown in on top of that, which then sent crude oil even higher. Russia thinking they were going to own Ukraine in a matter of a few days. And here we are 4 years later, and the conflict is still active.
Before we let you go, Matt, I want to look at the global supply chain. Something weird happened since the 1970s oil shock. The United States became the world's leading producer of oil. People might look at that and say, well, yeah, that's over in Iran. We're producing so much oil. Why does what's happening over there affect our prices so much here?
The simple layman's terms, the oil market is a global exchange. We do not have it down to nation. The main confusion comes into play with regard to the United States, especially because every transaction for crude oil purchases are dealt with in U.S. dollars. And so I can see why inside this country we would have a little bit of confusion about that. And what I mean is that if Australia is selling oil to Japan, as just simply one example, that sale is going to take place in U.S. dollars. It's not going to take place in the Aussie dollar or the Japanese yen. It's going to be something that is handled in U.S. dollars. So because it's a global exchange, wherever we have an upset in prices when it comes to any place on this planet, we're going to see the global oil price continue to raise, and that is unfortunate.
Matt, thanks again for joining us.
Anytime.
That's Matt McLean, petroleum analyst at Gas Buddy, talking about what's driving the recent jump in gas prices and if we could see a turnaround after the market cooled a little yesterday. Diesel prices have also gone up in the last week. In Wisconsin, the average price jumped more than 50 cents from $3.76 a gallon last week to about $4.30 currently. Elsewhere in the country, some places, diesel sits at $5 a gallon. Pam Polyak is president and owner of Polyak Trucking, a family-owned and operated cargo and logistics company based in Waukesha County. Pam, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
A 50-cent spike per gallon in diesel. Now, in the short term, I imagine you could ride with that. But how big a deal is that for your business, for the trucking industry, if we saw persistent increases in diesel like that?
Oh, it's a quick turnaround in terms of the pocketbook right away. I mean, we have to pay for fuel in order to run the load. So although we wait, 30 days to get paid for the load, it's the concept that we're buying the fuel right away to even make that trip to begin with. So from a diesel end from the EIA, they came out today saying the Midwest average for diesel is 4.8, which is up an entire dollar from last week at this time. So we're using a week lag to determine what that number is, and then customers apply a fuel surcharge based on what the EIA came out with on that number. So now this week, our rates will increase this week based on that number, but we're not getting paid for another 30 days. So we're dishing out about being a local carrier here in Wisconsin. Each truck averages about 350 gallons a week, and we just kind of run local, Wisconsin, Illinois, that type of market. So if you're putting in about 300 gallons and you're up a dollar, the math is simple on that one. We're dishing out a lot more and faster than what we're getting the money in.
It adds up fast. Yeah.
Quickly.
Just like we did with Matt, though, I want to look in a little longer term perspective. Yeah, we see this jump in a week. What have we been seeing over the past couple of years? Where are we in that context of running your business for years now?
Well, 22 averaged a little bit higher than what it is this week. So 22 as a whole averaged high. If you go back even further, in 2008, 2009, when fuel numbers were extremely high, the recession was well on its way, trucking industry as a whole decided we need a fuel surcharge on the most programs that we have. So the general idea and the industry standard is that fuel surcharge applies to most loads. So you've got that working with us, meaning that these things were already in place well before these spikes to kind of curate these spikes, but a dollar increase in a week is a lot to absorb because, again, we've got to wait that 30, 45 days. So although the number is not far off than what we saw in 22 and 23 as averages, it's obviously a drastic spike just in this week's time that will easily take 30 to 45 days to recover from on a general basis. So if it continues to go up as dramatic as it is right now, the hits will just keep coming a lot faster.
Now, somebody might be listening thinking, well, I don't put diesel in my car, so this doesn't really affect me. Well, hang on. Everything we buy, just about, Pam, right, is brought on a truck or maybe a diesel-powered train. These things translate into costs for consumers, right?
100% of the time. So it's the idea of if the fuel surcharge is up a dollar, every customer has a different fuel surcharge matrix. So it can go up 1 penny for every 5 cents it goes up is a pretty standard level of increase. So on average, if the customer's turning around and spending $20 to $30 more on a load, that amount will then trickle down to the end user and consumer eventually. Is it a magic switch? No, but it's that entire idea of things costing more. But we also have a secondary thing that's happening out, you know, in the Middle East, and because of everything that's happening right now, is that containers are getting stuck out there. So we're going to start seeing a very pre or post COVID type era where shipping containers are sitting in the middle of the ocean and we don't have access to them, meaning the trucking companies who need to haul the freight. So if things don't kind of turn around fairly quickly, we could run into a situation where your washing machine is now taking 6 months to get to you. Your dryer, your dishwasher, whatever it is, your appliance that you ordered that ships from overseas is going to get held up in the ocean. And now we're combating that on top of fuel prices and long delays on shipping.
That's interesting. What would be the timeline? This is just early days here. What would be the timeline where trucking companies like you start to see fewer orders, right? You're less booked up because that stuff is stuck at sea.
We could probably see it in the next 2 to 3 weeks, I'd say. It took us a little bit when things in 20 and 21 started happening in the Red Sea and we wanted it to open back up and things started flowing more. When there's different issues going on in the Panama Canal and the safe way that the ships have to go through, all of those things impact us and impact at the ports. Now, from a Wisconsin standpoint, it doesn't hit us quite as quickly, meaning it's the West Coast and East Coast that sees it first, meaning those are your giant hubs. Mm-hmm. Our closest hub is Chicago, and obviously that's not necessarily directly coming off of ships. That's all trains. So it takes a while for the Midwest to really see it. But depending on exactly how long this takes, we could end up seeing ships stuck there for weeks at a time, and then things aren't moving nearly as quickly, and the ripple effect will hit the Midwest eventually if things don't start to turn around.
We'll leave it there. Pam, thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's Pam Poliak, president and owner of Poliak Trucking, a family-owned and operated cargo and logistics company based in Waukesha County. Earlier heard from Matt McLean with Gas Buddy. We've been talking about this week's hike in gas and diesel prices, with Wisconsin seeing a 40-cent jump in the price per gallon at the pump, diesel up more than 50 cents. Coming up, new federal standards mean more people receiving food assistance have to satisfy work requirements. Find out how Wisconsin is putting those regulations into practice and what it means for people who count on food aid.
The time it takes to go through these processes is absolutely one of the barriers that does stop people from applying for benefits.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Barrett. New work requirements took effect at the beginning of this month to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as Food Share, here in Wisconsin. Work requirements mean that many adults are required to provide proof of work or job training at least 80 hours per month to receive benefits, with some exceptions. But those exceptions are changing under these new rules, meaning more people will be required to provide proof of employment or education. Advocates and researchers say the changes could affect tens of thousands of Wisconsin residents. Who in Wisconsin is affected, and what do the changes mean for them? Brooklyn Gray is food share manager for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, the largest hunger relief organization in the state. Brooklyn, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
All right, we've got these new changes when it comes to work requirements for food share and exemptions to them. What kind of concerns are you seeing from food share recipients that you work with as these changes roll out?
Yeah, it's been quite a few months of just Department of Health Services slowly getting these changes in place. So a lot of the confusion we're hearing from folks is honestly just around when these changes are taking place, if they apply to people, if they do apply to different people and families, like what actions do they need to take to maintain their benefits? And honestly, we've had a lot of concerns that people think SNAP is ending. So we've just done a lot of work to make sure we're sharing out, no, program's still here. The rules are just changing for some people. And then just doing our best job to make sure folks are understanding what the program is, how to maintain benefits, and what these new rules are.
I gotta say, I've been digging around and I found a little baffling, the timeline on when these rules hit. Can you spell it out for me? Because I've been stumped as I try to research this.
With the work requirement for food share, Wisconsin has been taking the last several months to make sure that we're all on the same page as a state with the federal government's new rules for the work requirement. And so the biggest changes has been the groups of people who the work requirement applied to. Previously, there were several exemptions in place for these different groups to not need to meet the work requirement. Just as a general reminder, for people who do need to meet the work requirement, it's about 80 hours a month, about 20 hours a week of work in order to receive food share. The typical exemptions for food share include folks who are disabled, people who are elderly, people who are unable to work due to an illness or injury or a physical or a mental barrier. But previous exemptions also existed that are now slowly being unwound. And so in December of 2025, the first round of those changes started taking place for new people who were applying and people who were renewing their benefits, because you do have to renew and keep up to date with all your information. So in December, the age of people who were previously exempt was changed. So prior to December 2025, if you were aged 54 or older or under the age of 18, you were exempt from the work requirement. In December, they expanded that a little bit. So you were not exempt from the work requirement until you were 60 years old. So that age went up. In addition, families who had minor children in the home, so kiddos who were 17 and younger, those families were exempt from the work requirement. Now that new rule is, unless you have a child in the home who is younger than 14, so 13 years or younger, that's no longer an exemption. So if all your kiddos in the home are 14 through 17 years, that's no longer an exemption for the work requirement.
Now, even before these those exemptions changed, we had work requirements for some people. How smooth is that process? What are the barriers for people who don't have those exemptions and do have to prove these that they meet these work and or education requirements?
Absolutely. So the overall work requirement, those 80 hours, typically have to be approved by the most common is when you go through an application or a renewal, you have to submit your most recent 30 days of pay. So if you're paid biweekly, it is your two most recent pay stubs. If you're paid weekly, it is the most recent four. If you just started your job, there's a form that you can fill out with your employer or a supervisor that just fills out your hourly rate. And this is how the state is able to verify that you're meeting the hourly requirement for the work requirement. So those barriers, oftentimes it's pay stubs are digital. How do I submit those to an office if I don't have an online account or I can't get to the office? If you're brand new to the job and you don't know your supervisor that well, or you don't know if they'll fill out the paperwork, maybe there's a delay in getting that form filled out and submitted. A lot of what we do as advocates at Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin is we help with submitting that paperwork. We help with creating the online access accounts to submit paperwork online. I fax paperwork almost every week for people just to try to make that process easier. But we do find that little bit of paperwork, that little detail about those 30 days, that does tend to be one of those barriers in certifying the work hours.
One concern I've had with work requirements, whether it's food aid or things like Medicaid, is, okay, if I have a retail job and I work 20 hours a week, easy peasy to prove that. If I am cobbling together, I'm doing some rideshare work for a while, I'm doing seasonal work when a harvest is coming in, whatever, I don't have the regular hours. Are there edge cases like that where people are having trouble establishing that they meet these requirements?
Yes, absolutely. Once you start having income from multiple places, it just adds to the burden of like how much paperwork a person needs to submit. The paperwork for the gig work, like Uber, babysitting, caring for a family member or whatever, if you're receiving pay for those activities, there is a form Wisconsin has called this self-employment verification form. It is for the most part, very straightforward, but it feels overwhelming because the way that form is built is if you had your whole own business, and a lot of people don't realize you can skip the salary, the insurance, the rent, your capital expenses, you can skip a lot of that. All that they're looking for is just for you to fill out how many hours a month you're working and about how much you earned that month and from whom, like, you earned that money from. And so explaining, like, this very intimidating looking paperwork to people, that's also what we do, and just try to make that a little bit more approachable. But it's absolutely a barrier for a lot of folks.
One concern that comes up with work requirements is, hey, there might be some people who are eligible, right? They meet the standards, but because of the bureaucracy, they ultimately don't get the benefits. Is that something you run into as you work with people? Is that something that you're concerned about?
So when we assist with people with applications or we're educating people on food share, we are always very honest about the time it takes to go through this process. So whether it is the application itself, the food share interview, or following up with that paperwork. And sometimes we do get people who are going, I don't have time for this. Thank you so much, but I'm good. And we never push people, like, it's always other people's choice on whether they want to apply or not. But the time it takes to go through these processes is absolutely one of the barriers that does stop people from applying for benefits.
When these requirements are put in place, often there's a concern that, hey, there are people who could be working, should be working. They're kind of taking advantage of the system to get food aid instead of working. I know probably you don't go into it trying to judge each and every person coming in, but what do you say to people who raise those concerns?
Honestly, it is years and years and years of misunderstanding the program. I've been in this work for several years now, and not at any point, perhaps maybe like during the pandemic, there was a loosening of the work requirement, but people have always had to work in order to receive food share. The people who genuinely can't work are usually, it's usually due to a disability. It's due to age. It's due to not being able to find work because they live in a rural place and maybe they don't have consistent transportation. I think that is one of the largest misconceptions about food share as a program, is that people are leaning on it and scooting around the system and what have you. But the work requirement is required for every person, unless you have like an approved, one of the very few, but approved exemptions for not working.
Brooklyn, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
No worries.
Brooklyn Gray is food share manager for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, the largest hunger relief organization in the state. For more on the larger impact of these changes, Sarah Halpern-Meekin is here. She's director of the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison and Bascom Professor of Women, Family, and Community in the School of Human Ecology. Sarah, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
What sort of impact do you see these changes in work requirements, these changes in exemptions having on the number of people who are able to access food aid?
So the estimates that I've seen from the state are that about 44,000 people are likely to be newly subject to these work requirements. And so that raises the question of how many of them will possibly lose benefits if they have challenges either complying with those rules or challenges completing the paperwork to show that they're complying with those rules.
As a policy choice, the idea behind the work requirements is, hey, we think some people may be using this that don't need it. They should be in the workforce instead. And the positive way to look at it is, hey, these are people who, you know, they could be adding to the state's workforce, bringing a lot of economic benefit. What do we know about the impact of these kind of work requirements when it gets, you know, to bringing people back into jobs?
So you raise a really good point, right? What is the purpose of this kind of policy change? We know already before this policy change that most people who were on SNAP were either children, older adults, or were working. And so it's not that there's this very large portion of people who are in their prime working years and have no disabilities who are not working and receiving SNAP. But the idea of this is to be encouraging people to be in the workforce and be limiting their access to benefits if they're not in the workforce. And what we've seen in previous research is that with past increases in SNAP work requirements, they have led to declines in SNAP enrollment, but there have not been any increases in employment. So that hope that the incentive of being able to get ongoing SNAP assistance if you are complying with work requirements would increase work has not been borne out in previous instances of increased work requirements.
Do we know why that is? Is it just that, hey, this might be an area where the work isn't available, or why isn't it working as intended?
So the research that I've seen suggests that what happens primarily is that people have trouble complying with the paperwork required to document their work activities in the way that's required by the law. So that is, they're losing benefits, not because they're unwilling to follow the rules, but because it's difficult to jump through the hoops necessary to show that they're following the rules.
Now, we've been focusing on what this means for individual people who might receive food aid. Another change here in the new requirements, Wisconsin would need to keep the food share error rate under 6%, which in my understanding, Wisconsin already does. Some states don't. Can you talk about that error rate for food share payments as part of this policy?
Yeah, so Wisconsin is in a fortunate position that the error rate is below that 6% threshold. What happens when states get above that 6% threshold is eventually they will start having to pay for part of the costs of the benefits. So right now, the situation has been that the administrative costs are shared between the federal government and the state, although the state is now expected to pick up even more of the administrative costs than before. But the costs of the benefit themselves have been borne by the federal government. For states with higher error rates above that 6% threshold, they will start being responsible for some of the costs, which could put states in a bad financial position or lead them to decide they can't afford to pay for the benefits people are entitled to.
When it comes to implementing these work requirements, what kind of flexibility do states have as far as timing, how they implement it, how much assistance they might provide to people to help them fill out the paperwork on all of this? What could Wisconsin do differently potentially than other states?
Well, I know that the state is working on that now, has been rolling out these changes. So we had this increase where work requirements used to only be for people up to age 54, and now that's been expanded to 64. So the state has done that incrementally, moved it up to 59 first, and then is moving it up to 64 to try to help people adjust over time. And they're trying to communicate with people to make sure that they know if they are newly subject to these requirements so that they can get together the paperwork that they need to comply with them. You know, there is only so much the state can do because the rules are set at the federal level. So the state can try to help people comply. The state can task caseworkers and counties with working with people if they have the case for a good cause exemption to the work requirements. But fundamentally, the state has to follow the rules that are set out at the federal level, and they can just try to help individuals to the best of their ability to follow those rules as well.
I want to look at the community impact here. If because of these requirements, a lot of people lose their food assistance in an area with higher poverty. And you could picture maybe that's a part of a city or part of a rural county that has a higher reliance on food aid. Is there a spillover benefit if lots of people in that area aren't getting that aid? What does that mean for the grocery stores and the wider economy of that area?
That's a really good point. And it brings up two aspects of what we're seeing change, right? So one of the changes, one of these policy changes, is that people who are living in areas of high unemployment that threshold for what's considered an area of high unemployment, making you no longer have to abide by those work requirements, that threshold of high unemployment has been raised. So there will be some areas where everyone used to be exempt from work requirements that no longer are because of that increased unemployment threshold. The question you were asking, though, you know, really points out that SNAP use varies a lot from place to place within cities and also especially between counties. You know, we look at a place like Dane County, SNAP receipt is around 8% of people. In Adams or Ashland, the rate's more like 16 or 17% of people. And so, you know, we're talking about a really large proportion of the local population. If a number of those people were to lose their SNAP benefits, that's fewer dollars being spent in local stores. It also means likely a higher demand at local food pantries.
Sarah, as we wrap up, it's still early days on these changes in exceptions on these work requirements for food assistance. What are you watching for as these come into full effect over the next couple of few years?
We're really going to be watching those SNAP receipt rates, and we're going to be watching what proportion of people fall off those SNAP rolls. And we really want to understand why that's happening. If they're coming off the SNAP rolls because they've gotten a well-paid job and they don't need those benefits anymore, then that's a win. If they're coming off the SNAP rolls because they can't comply with the paperwork, and they are following the work requirement rules and they still are in need of food assistance, then we have a larger problem for that individual and for our state.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Halperin-Meekin is director of the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison and Bascom Professor of Women, Family, and Community in the School of Human Ecology. Earlier, we spoke with Brooklyn Gray, food share manager for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, the largest hunger relief organization in the state, looking at changes in work requirements for food aid. Coming up in Eau Claire, author has a new picture book about making forts. The book was selected for Dolly Parton's Imagination Library.
It's the Mount Everest of picture book writing. It felt wonderful and humbling and all those feelings.
Tens of thousands of kids will be able to read forts with their caregivers. Meet the author on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Think back on your childhood memories for a moment. What was your favorite fort you ever built as a kid? We had this old school heavy duty dining room table that sort of doubled as our tornado shelter. With some sheets and pillows, you could get a surprisingly big fort out of that thing. Now for Eau Claire children's book author Katie Vennett.
The world is filled with forts. Tiny worlds within this world, safe as coat pockets.
That's Vennett reading from Forts. It's her new picture book about all sorts of forts and how they make us feel.
Scoot into the hideout behind a waterfall, where washed rocks smell of minerals. Plink, plunk, whoosh. Foxes, owls, and raccoons live in wild forts. They may share with you for a moment.
Vennett's book was recently selected for Dolly Parton's Imagination Library. That's a free global program delivering books to children in the mail up to age 5. It means tens of thousands of kids will be reading forts with their caregivers this year.
No matter the fort, forts are for friends, because only friends can share a fort.
In a bit, we'll hear about efforts to keep the Imagination Library in Eau Claire for years to come. But first, Katie Vennett recently talked with Kate Archer Kent about her new book.
How does it feel to learn that your book, Forts, was chosen for Dolly Parton's Imagination Library?
It was amazing. Being chosen for the Dolly Parton Imagination Library is every picture book writer's dream. It's the Mount Everest of picture book writing. It felt wonderful and kind of scary and humbling and all of those feelings.
Mm. How does the Imagination Library work? Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. It's a nonprofit that Dolly Parton started in 2002. And she just started it in her local county. And then it was so successful that she worked on expanding it out. And now it's an international nonprofit. I believe it's the largest early literacy nonprofit in the world. Mm-hmm. And any child from age 0 to 5, there's no income requirements. Any child can receive free books every month, one free book every month, as long as they live in a county where the program is offered. So it's offered in every state, but not every county. And fundraising works on the local level. So each county has to raise the money for the program locally. And then they get a book that's chosen. Every child in the country gets the same book for that age group the same month. So, for example, every child born in 2022 who's enrolled in the program in the U.S. will be getting Forts in August.
Mm. Where did you come up with the idea for the book? Why Forts?
Well, I loved making Forts as a child. I have two brothers and a sister, and that was one of our favorite activities, is building forts in our living room. We had a treehouse in the backyard. It was just a platform that had been nailed into a maple tree. but we called it a treehouse. And we built forts in our living room and in the basement and basically in every room of the house whenever we could. And then when I had my own children, I carried that forward and we built forts together. And I remembered how fun it was to crawl into the space that a child could create and decorate however they want. You know, we'd get those giant boxes for dog food or whatever.
Yeah.
And I just let my children draw all over them however they wanted to decorate them. And we'd make these massive structures in the living room. And I just remember how empowering that was to be able to make this little world all your own. And somehow it just turned into a picture book. I just started writing it down one day, and my children gave me some tips and they gave me some notes. And we went out and we looked for more forts out in the woods, you know, little homes where animals might live. And those made their way into the manuscript as well. And it just kind of came together. It was it was one of the easiest books I've ever written. I think it just drew from that deep well within me of just loving forts for the last, you know, 40 plus years.
You make it sound so easy, but the language in picture books, I mean, words are scarce. How do you go about selecting just the right words?
Normally picture books are not easy. I've worked on picture books for years and years before I thought they were ready. For this, I wanted the language to feel cozy and to match the imagery. So it was just a matter of swapping out words, which is a cozy word, which is not a cozy word. Lichen, for example, not that cozy. Did not make it into the book. but then I also looked for sounds, like that O sound is a really cozy sound. So I tried to work in the O sound whenever I could. Forts, world, maroon. So it was just playing with sounds and how they sound when you read them aloud, and what kind of feeling do those give you.
And the feeling has to also extend to the adult or the caregiver, the parent who is reading the book to the child as well. How do you include them in the picture book?
That's a great question. That is one of the great challenges of writing picture books, is to write something that appeals to the child and the adult, because if either one of those two don't like the picture book, it won't get read. Or it'll get read once, but it won't make it into the regular rotation. And what we really want is to write books that make it into the regular rotation. So I think with Forts, I think it appeals to adults because they, like me, remember building forts as children and remember that they have that nostalgia and that feeling of coziness and empowerment.
And so I think that appeals to adults. I've seen some parents start crying in my readings because they just remember these experiences that they had as children playing in forts.
Talking with you makes me wonder how you felt as a kid in your treehouse fort, because there's this moment in the picture book where you use the word like people-y when they're, you know, when the world's too people-y. Yeah. How did your fort make you feel?
Safe. Yeah. I was going for that too, is just that feeling of safety that a child has in a fort. I think there's a concept called play schemas. And these are common ways that children like to play. And one of them is called the enveloping, and there's another one called enclosing play schemas. And these are ideas that young children like to enclose themselves in things. They like to have smaller spaces. And I think that's really common. In our wonderful library in Eau Claire, we have a sculpture in the children's section that is this tiny cave. And kids can crawl into it. Adults can crawl into it too, but it is not comfortable, I can tell you. But it's just this feeling of being enclosed, and kids just love that feeling of being safe and having a small enclosure to be in.
Katie, thank you for sharing forts with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That is Katie Vennett, an Eau Claire-based children's author. Her picture book, Forts, was selected for Dolly Parton's Imagination Library. The program delivers free monthly books to children in the mail up to age 5. Now, to look at efforts to keep Eau Claire's Imagination Library going into the future, we're joined by author B.J. Hollers, an English professor at UW-Eau Claire. He's co-chair of the Imagination Fund campaign, which is raising money to continue Dolly Parton's Imagination Library in Eau Claire County. Hi, B.J. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Why encourage parents and kids in your community to read books like Katie's Forts together?
There are so many reasons why we should be encouraging this. I mean, scientifically, there's all kinds of studies that say things like, you know, 90% of a child's brain development occurs in the first 5 years, which is the exact time when this program takes place. If 30% of Eau Claire County households live below what is called the asset limited income constrained employed threshold, meaning it's hard for these families to buy books. So this is a way to help with that. And one of the best indications of how people will perform academically, it always starts with early exposure to books. And so it's so interesting in this kind of technological world we live in, where we think we need the fastest touchscreen to get ahead. In fact, it's just having a common book, and in fact, a lot of books in your household, that can make the biggest difference.
What is the impact of the Imagination Library program in your community?
It's huge. Tens of thousands of books have already been distributed. Worldwide, I'll add 200 million books have gone out thanks to Dolly Parton's Imagination Library. And so we are just one community. But already it's huge. And what we're trying to do is to find a way to make sure that this can continue in perpetuity. So we've got a $1.6 million campaign to make sure that every child in Eau Claire County, both today and tomorrow, can be a part of this for ages 0 through 5 for every month of those years.
And with that campaign, what do the funds go to support? Where do they go?
Yeah, great question. I think it's a little confusing for folks because we hear Dolly Parton and we think, oh, Dolly Parton must
be paying
for all this. She's
got it covered. Yeah.
She's got it all covered, which would be lovely, but she is doing her part, let me tell you. But what she does really is help facilitate, her group helps facilitate the bulk buy of all these books. And so it really is up to every individual community to find a way to fund this. The good news is, because of these deals, it's about $3 per book, and that includes shipping. And so it's a great bargain. I mean, literally for the price of half a cup of coffee these days, you can get a book into a child's hands. So it's really impressive. And so the money we earn goes to pretty much offset those costs to ensure that the books can be sent to children in our own backyards and our neighbors and friends.
So what is the benefit then of having the Imagination Library program in addition to what traditional community libraries offer?
That's a great question. Of course, never want to say a negative thing about the library. That is a perfect place to get so much of this work done. But there's something really special, and I've seen it in my own household and my friends' households, where you know, a child runs to the mailbox because they know that book is coming, and they open the flap and they see their name right there beneath the address, and they see the book that is theirs, and then they run it inside, and a loving adult or a sibling of theirs gets to read it with them. And that's what's so cool about it. No one needs to drive a kid to the library. For those folks who maybe don't have access to those places all the time, it goes right to the kid, and the kid takes such ownership over the book. And it is just so exciting to see my own daughter have her own little shelf of Dolly Parton books, you know, and to return to them and tell people, this is my book. And it's really kind of an empowering thing for a child to have ownership over a book, or in this case, a series of books.
What is reading like in the Hollers household?
Oh, gosh. Well, I wish there was more of it. I have some older kids now who are, reading digitally at best. But for the younger one, especially, it is a nighttime thing, you know, and just the selection of the book. For me as a writer, I mean, the most exciting part just happened last week, where we transitioned from reading the book to writing the book. And so she's got her big stack of books over here on her left, and she's got her markers and paper over here, and she'll read a little bit and get inspired and write a couple pages. And that's how it works for a lot of writers. You know, you stand on the shoulders of giants, you read what came before, and then you find that fire and try to contribute to it.
Oh, I love that story, and where she finds inspiration then in the books she's read, and then she tries it out a little bit step by step on her own.
Well, and then she has her own reading for the whole family, you know, so it's just, it's such a cool thing to see that, you know, she feels that she's a part of it too, and that's a great thing.
How is the fundraising going for the Imagination Fund?
Yeah, we are on our way. We spent a lot of the first year, we're still in our first year, kind of laying the groundwork, you know, so we're still kind of in the silent part of the campaign, looking for those big corporate donors to step up, but also individuals, you know. And so over the next year, we're really going to do our best to make the most headway, but we feel like we're in a good place, and now is truly a time for folks who've got enough money to support even a single child for a year. You know, $3 a book is not much over 12 months. It's $36 or so. So there's a lot of people who can jump on board and be a part of this.
And then finally, how does this program set Eau Claire County apart in terms of, you know, building up community and helping a young generation get a good start?
Well, let me just first of all say how exciting it is that we have one of our very own Eau Clairians, Katie, with this book that will be a part of this library. I mean, I walk the same trails Katie walks. I probably see a lot of the same forts in the woods. And it's just so exciting to live in a community where we can say, hey, that book you just got in the mail, that was written by someone who lives right down the street from us, you know. And so it is just an unbelievably fortuitous connection to have Katie's book selected at this very moment in time. I don't know of any other community that can say that, but it's huge. I mean, as someone who's pretty involved in the literary and the art scenes around here, what I love about the adult art scene is that we all play so collaboratively together. You know, a musician has an idea, they can call a writer, they'll call a painter, we'll get the room, it'll happen, you know. And I think it all sort of starts with stuff like this. When a child can understand this book is mine, can share it with their friends, then maybe they want to write their own, and then maybe they can share it with others. And so building this mentality of working together and sharing what we create, it's just the first step to a lifetime of that.
BJ, good to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Author BJ Hollers is an English professor at UW Eau Claire. He co-chairs the Imagination Fund campaign, raising money to continue providing free monthly book deliveries to young children in Eau Claire County. Earlier, we heard from Katie Vennett, an Eau Claire-based children's book author. Her book, Forts, was selected for Dolly Parton's Imagination Library. Talking about a picture book about childhood forts, and wonder if you recall the joy of building a fort as a kid. What were some of your favorite tools? Was it the blankets, couch cushions, or cardboard boxes? Where did you build your best forts? Who did you invite into them? Share your fort building memories, or if you've passed fort building down to a young child in your life, what's it like to build a fort with a kid? Share your story. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can leave us a message or text us. Either way, that number is 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson, Trevor Hook, and Beatrice Lawrence. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.